The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. From 2020 until their arrests in 2023, the Drug User Liberation Front provided a safe supply of drugs to a small number of people who use drugs in that part of northern Abya-Yala known colonially as Vancouver, BC. The drugs were sourced via the dark web, purity and potency tested with a mass spectrometer. Dulf used a Compassion Club model. Members were carefully screened. Prices were kept low. No deaths resulted from the use of drugs obtained through Dulf. Two of Dulf's organizers and public spokespeople, Eris Nix and Jeremy Callicum, were arrested in October of 2023 and charged in May of 2024. As loyal listeners know, we've been following this story for the last few years, and well, it's time for an update. Dulf held a news conference on Tuesday, October 15th. Let's listen. The next voice you hear will be that of Dulf co-founder Eris Nix. They'll be followed by Dulf co-founder Jeremy Callicum.
So, thanks everyone for coming. I think we want to approach this as somberly as possible, because this is the eighth year of a public health crisis, and this public health crisis is one of the worst, if not the worst, that's ever impacted British Columbia. Very little is being done to prevent deaths, which are skyrocketing. Each month, an airplane full of people dies from a deregulated and toxic drug supply. This drug supply has adulterants such as fentanyl and benzodiazepine, which are causing massive devastation in our communities, to our friends, to our families, to our loved ones, and to the people we know and care about the most. And what Dulf has done has always come from a place of love and caring. The purpose of this press conference is to make clear and to prove the constitutionality of our project. We have the support of our community behind us. We have the support of some fantastic lawyers. And we want to demonstrate how deeply unfair and discriminatory it is to prevent drug users from saving lives, from saving the lives of the people they care about the most. We are not against a full continuum of care. We believe that you need interventions such as abstinence-based recovery, such as treatment. But our issue is that continuum of care drops off and that people are dying who on the daily have to access this toxic and deregulated supply of drugs. In this crisis, it is a shame that to save lives is criminally, we are being criminally persecuted for saving lives. And I'm going to try and speak from the heart here. Again, this is the eighth year of a public crisis, public health crisis, publicly declared public health crisis. More Canadians have died from drug toxicity deaths from the deregulated illicit drug supply than died during the entirety of World War II since 2016. And in BC, over 14,000 people have lost their lives. This is 5% of the total amount of people who are currently at risk, which the coroner has placed at approximately 250,000 people. This crisis disproportionately impacts Indigenous folks, people of color, and other marginalized groups. And nowhere is this more apparent than in Vancouver's downtown east side. The location where Dulf ran its Compassion Club project. The overdose death rate in our community is 556.8 per 100,000 people. That rate is 12 times higher than BC's 2023 rate and 27 times higher than the Canadian national average. These deaths are caused by the deregulation of the illicit drug supply. And that is a byproduct of a prohibitionist regime, a regime which is outdated and dangerous to folks who use drugs, specifically folks that are dependent on those drugs, our most marginalized members of society, people who choose to use drugs and have no other option but to use those drugs, or else they will become ill and put themselves at risk. This problem stems from the fact that people do not know what they are putting into their bodies. And what we need to see change to fix this situation is some type of regulation of the illicit drug market. Organized crime thrives on this market and generates money from prohibition. And organized crime does not care about regulating the potency of drugs, insofar as it is easier to smuggle more potent substances, and it is not in their interest to spend the time to label and test substances. We have heard from the government that they will take a medicalized approach, a prescriber-based approach to this problem, but these solutions are inappropriate and will not be expanded rapidly enough to save the lives we are losing now. The medical model is inappropriately applied in many different ways. There are concerns about whether or not this system is culturally appropriate and whether or not cultural safety exists in the healthcare system. There are limited hours for prescribers and pharmacies, and the implementation of safer drug use prescribing among prescribers is very limited, especially outside of urban centers. There are also issues related to the diagnostic and monitoring requirements and urine drug screenings and witness of drug consumption associated with these programs. As many of you know, there is also a lack of access to primary health care providers and a limited scope of suitable pharmaceutical options. It is from this standpoint that Dolph ran a market regulation project, a project designed to save the lives of folks we care about most. And I'm going to hand the mic over to Jeremy, who's going to speak a bit to that.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Jeremy Callicum, and I'm one of the co-founders of the Drug User Liberation Front. As Aris mentioned, the Dolph project was designed to test what a level of regulation could do to people's lives and the community as a research initiative. What we wanted to do was to generate evidence to see what an empirical response to the worst public health crisis in Canadian history. We wanted to make sure that what we were developing and testing could fit into the existing models of care, which are not enough. We don't have enough resources put into the substance use continuum of care to support people as is. The wait lists to get into recovery are months, if not a year long. I've tried to help people get through this system, and they cannot get in. So what do we do for the people in the meantime? And there's lots of rhetoric put into this, and it's politically heated. But what we need to do is look at this empirically. We need to get data. We need to look at the data. We can't just throw ideas into the air and point at which we think is best. We need to do measurements. And that's what we wanted to do. And as with any sort of initiative, research or program-based, we believed that transparency and accountability were critically important, and we strived at every step to maintain that within our organization. We talked to whoever we could, whenever we could, to get input on what we were doing, and this included talking to police, to every level of government, to the health authorities, to research institutions, treatment centers, community, the media, and the public. Further to this point, the highest public health official in the land, as it relates to the mental health and addictions, the federal mental health and addictions minister, came to a visit to the club and has publicly acknowledged that. before any of the enforcement happened. At every step of the way, with every stakeholder we talked to, we asked for feedback, we asked for concerns. We had never gotten any concerns. To every stakeholder, they only gave us praise for what we were doing. It is mind-blowing that what precipitated the enforcement against us was politicization. When we talked to these stakeholders, we said that we would address any concerns, and this included shutting down. If at any point any stakeholder would have asked us to shut down, we would have, but nobody ever did. Of course, we always believed that the Compassion Club was a sensible, rational, and urgently needed response in a full spectrum of care to the overdose emergency. And to this extent, we did research, and we measured, and we published 2 peer-reviewed papers with more in the peer review process right now, reviewed by experts in the field, in academic journals. In our qualitative research, we found statistically significant reductions in overdose that required naloxone administration, a statistically significant reduction in overdoses overall. When we observed people at the club using the substances provided by Dolph, we witnessed no overdoses among thousands of uses. This would not happen with street drugs. You would see overdoses. We also saw a statistically significant reduction in the amount of hospitalizations for our members. These are groundbreaking findings that need to be looked at. For them to just be shucked to the side is politicization at its most heinous. We also conducted qualitative research where we asked our participants what they were experiencing from being members in the club. In this research, we found that 64% of our participants reported that it helped them reduce their drug use. Being a member of the club helped people who are using substances use less substances. 22.4% of our participants reported that being a member of the Compassion Club helped them stop using drugs. On the community level, 74% of our participants said that being involved in the club helped them reduce criminal activity. 87% of our members reported that illicit drug use, that they no longer needed to use illicit drugs from the illicit market. They could access their drugs from a regulated source. 90% of our participants reported that it reduced their risk of overdose. 72% reported that it reduced their risk of violence. And 75% reported that it reduced their negative interactions with police. So what we're seeing is reduced overdoses, reduced money going into the illicit market, and reductions in crime. These are things we all want to see in society, and this is something that the Compassion Club can contribute to. In terms of positive effects, we saw that 52% of our club members reported increased connections to their friends and family. We saw that 85% reported increased use of sterile equipment to prevent bloodborne pathogens and illness. 74% reported improvements in their mental health, 63% reported improvements in their physical health, and 70% reported improvements in their overall well-being. All in all, the club had a spectacularly positive effect on the community and individuals, and it can't be ignored.
This is a news conference held by the Drug User Liberation Front on Tuesday, October 15th. We just heard Dolph co-founders Aris Nix and Jeremy Callicum. We'll hear more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Let's get back to it. The next voice you hear will be that of attorney Stephanie Dixon. She'll be followed by attorney Tim Dixon.
My name is Stephanie Dixon. I, along with Tim Dixon, represent both Jeremy and Aris. As you're well aware, Jeremy and Aris were arrested last year on charges of possession for the purposes of trafficking. And those charges were approved in May. And the Compassion Club that was saving lives was shut down. The trial is currently scheduled to begin in October of next year. And one of the defenses Tim and I will be advancing is that the Compassion Club was in fact exempted from the criminal prohibition on PPT. The Compassion Club was and had been designated an urgent public health needs site, which exempts such sites from certain provisions of the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act, including Section 5, sub 2, the provision under which Aris and Jeremy were charged. In addition, we expect to demonstrate that to any extent that designation did not exempt the Compassion Club from Section 5, sub 2 of the CDSA, then that provision breaches Section 7 and Section 15 of the Charter. And I'll turn it over to Tim to elaborate on those arguments.
Good morning, everyone. Good, my name's Tim Dixon. I'm a lawyer at JFK Law LLP and in practice in constitutional law for the most part. So we have filed our notice of constitutional question and charter application in the case. And again, as Stephanie was just explaining, the purpose of that constitutional challenge is that to any extent that the criminal prohibition on possession for the purposes of trafficking applied here to Dolph's Compassion Club, we say that provision is unconstitutional because it violates certain provisions of the Charter of Rights, and those are Section 7 and Section 15. So let me just outline a little bit what that constitutional challenge is about. Section 7 guarantees the right not to be deprived of life, liberty, or security of the person except in accordance with the principles of fundamental justice, which is a bit of a mouthful, but let me unpack that for you. One of those principles is arbitrariness, and another is gross disproportionality. And here, with Dolph's Compassion Club, at trial, the evidence will show very clearly that prohibiting the Compassion Club members from accessing this safer, predictable, known supply of drugs forces them to obtain their drugs from the unpredictable, toxic street supply. And that exposes them to all the risks that the toxic street supply entails, risks of death and risks of serious injury. And so it limits their lives. It risks depriving them of their lives. It risks serious injury. And we say that is arbitrary. The objectives of the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act are public health and public safety. And the Compassion Club advanced public health and public safety. It protected lives. It protected members against serious injury. It reduced other safety concerns. And so we say it is arbitrary for the state to criminalize possession for the purposes of trafficking as it applies to Dolph's Compassion Club. Another principle of fundamental justice is that you cannot criminalize behavior if that would have a grossly disproportionate impact on people. And if you, in doing that, you're limiting their rights to life, liberty, or security of the person. And that's exactly what the prohibition does when it's applied to Dolph. As I've just said, there's the prohibition does not advance public health and public safety. It undermines those objectives. But if anyone thought there was any benefit in prohibiting this program, the impacts on the members so outweigh any such benefits. They are that the prohibition is grossly disproportionate. Again, the impacts on the members are very severe. They're forced to turn to the street supply to obtain their drugs, where they're exposed to all the unpredictability of the toxic drug supply. And so we say that Section 7 is violated in that way as well. And then there's Section 15. Section 15 is the right to equality, the right to be free from discriminatory application of laws. And here the members of the Compassion Club, of course, all had serious dependencies on these drugs. This is not a situation where they can just stop using these drugs. This is not a just say no kind of situation. These are extremely addictive drugs that must be accessed by members multiple times a day in order to avoid withdrawal. And so the result of prohibiting the Compassion Club is to force them back onto the street supply again, where they face those severe risks of death and injury. And it draws that distinction on the basis of a recognized disability, which is addiction, of course. And so those are the arguments we are going to be making on the constitutional challenge at trial. Again, the prohibition that of the Compassion Club, the charges that have been leveled against Aris and Jeremy are unconstitutional because they violate Section 7 and 15 of the Charter of Rights. And we will make those arguments on the basis of a large body of very specific, very well-developed evidence. And that evidence will demonstrate these severe risks of the toxic drug supply. The evidence will demonstrate the efficacy of the Compassion Club's approach to safer supply. And in particular, it'll demonstrate that this Compassion Club did reduce the risks of death and injury that arise with the toxic drug crisis, and that they led to a number of other positive benefits, as Jeremy has laid out. We are obviously very disappointed by the shift in the political discourse on drug policy in BC in recent months. And we're particularly disappointed that the Crown would approve these charges against Aris and Jeremy for running a program that actually did save lives in the midst of this crisis. But the advantage of the court case is that it's an opportunity to have these issues decided on the basis of evidence and of logic by an independent and impartial judge. And it will be a very different process than the political debate that's been going on in recent months, which is more about sound bites than facts. And so in this way, we welcome this opportunity.
And just in closing, I want to make one final brief comment, just to say what this case is not about. This case is not about BC's decriminalization experiment. It's not about other harm reduction efforts. It's not about involuntary treatment. It's not about more voluntary treatment. It is about Dolph's specific and targeted program and whether it's constitutionalized, constitutional to criminalize a program that was actually saving lives.
My other question is for Jeremy and Aris. It's been a year since you two were arrested and in June charges were laid. A lot of people, I guess, in the media at least, haven't been able to speak to you two for some time. But since then, there's been pretty open, marches of support for you two, for Dolph. How have you two been since the arrest, since the charges were laid, and since you've been able to see all this support for your guys' case?
Yeah, I'll say that the support that we've seen since our arrests has been phenomenal and helped me get through this difficult time. Of course, this is never something that I wanted to experience, being arrested, going through, being charged, and having to defend myself with the help of the community and our lawyers in court. especially for something that I did that was positive, that helped save lives, that not only did I believe, but know was a positive for people and for society. And to be criminalized for that is, heartbreaking and shakes your kind of foundational sense of, right and wrong. But having the community come and continue to support us has made the world of difference for me.
And I don't, I don't really have that much to add to that. Obviously, the massive support from our community has been tremendously important to the both of us, as Jeremy has mentioned. But what I do want to add is I live in the downtown East Side, and this community, which is a very close-knit and beautiful and important community to me, is being absolutely devastated by the deregulation of the illicit drug market. We are losing people every day, and I'm not sure that folks really understand the magnitude of this crisis, but when we say 200 people per month die from the deregulation of the illicit drug market, that's an airplane full of people we're losing. And these aren't faceless people. These are people we all love and care about, people that frequently I see on the daily. And sometimes you have to respond to overdoses out on the street. More often than not, people are repeatedly overdosing. And this is all because of the deregulation of the illicit drug supply. And this issue has become so politicized that people are blinded from seeing how we can actually make progressive and transformative change. And I think really it is so important that something is done, because this will absolutely decimate the community I love and I care about and I call home. And it's eating me alive inside. And I think, you know, our actions come from a place of love and a place of care. No one wants to see anyone suffer. We want to see people live and live happy and joyful and fulfilling lives. And I do want to stress the fact that you cannot recover someone if they have passed away. Someone cannot go to abstinence-based treatment if they are dead. We need a full continuum of care, and we need to care. And I think care has been lacking for the past 8 years when it comes to public policy decision-making, and we need to start seeing a new path forward and start moving forward in a new direction. And I have so much love for everyone that supported us through the past year and, will continue to support us. And I know we have the community's back and the community has our back. So this all comes from a place of care and a place of love.
You just heard attorneys Stephanie Dixon and Tim Dixon and Dolph co-founders Aris Nix and Jeremy Callicum. They were speaking at the Drug User Liberation Front news conference October 15th, discussing Dolph's case and the new charter challenge they've just filed. For now, that's it. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.